with me on the panel to assist me go through this is Janelle DiGrucci, who is a resident of Cape Town in South Africa, and his father is a well-known South African theologian, and I'll also be assisted by Mudiehi. We are going to initiate this discussion by an input from both Janelle and Mudiehi of about 8 minutes each on primarily about six areas of South African life viewed from the black and white perspective, that is the black and white racial divide. Those will be A, the economic standard, or what you may call the standard of living. And then we'll go to the education standard, and look at the political involvement and political opinions of the people. And we'll look at religion and culture. And finally look at what are the areas of racial interaction, at what are what is the level of racial communication, and under what circumstances at all is there such a racial interaction. To a very large extent, both Mudiehi and Janelle will also give a perspective as women in South Africa. And that also can therefore facilitate discussions as to how is the perspective seen from the woman's point of view. And thereafter, after that input and an open discussion on the input, I will raise a question on the possibility of a non-racial society. And I'll ask specifically two questions. A, where in the world is that society in existence? Where can we refer to such a society in the world of a non-racial society? And what do we mean by a non-racial society? And what are the other options for the interracial future of South Africa that are being offered by various groups, from Mr. de Klerk's Nationalist Party to Mr. Mandela's African National Congress. And we hope that in an hour's time you would have had a lot, and you can also reflect on most of those things with your situation here in America. Well, without further ado, I'll ask Janelle to start her presentation.
Okay. There's a lot of ground to cover, so we're going to do it very briefly. Just address some of the areas, and then hopefully in the questions we can spend more time clarifying if you don't understand. I guess I'm just going to start with the interaction between the different races. One of the things that you need to be aware of is one of the main laws of apartheid is the Group Areas Act, and that dictates that people of different races live in different areas, and you can't, it's illegal to live in another area. So everything is very separate. So for example, when you talk about religion or whatever, you go to churches in your area, which is a white area, so all the church will be all white. The schools are all white or all black. They're very limited areas for interaction on a personal level. And for whites, you can live a very sheltered existence in a white suburb. You can never ever go into a township, see how blacks are living. Your contact with blacks would be generally kind of economic contact. In other words, white bosses and black workers, so that there would always be that dynamic. Or a white, homeowners and domestic servants. So this kind of employer-employee relationship and very limited equal interaction. And again, also there's different languages. So even on the streets, there's limited interaction because people are speaking different languages and it's difficult to get into what's going on with other people when you don't understand often what they're saying. Although that is a one-way thing, because I speak English, but I don't speak an African language, whereas those who speak African languages can generally speak English in the towns. On the economic level, we put up some statistics here, I think. Yeah, distribution of total income. Whites, who are 14% of the population, earn 60% of income. And Africans are 75% of the population, will earn 29% of the income. That's total income. And then another statistic is monthly wage in 1988. Black monthly wage average would be $175 and white would be $1,000. So there's a big discrepancy. Generally, whites are middle class. We kind of felt the majority of whites would be called middle class, although you have your wealthy class who own capital, and you have your working class, which would be largely Afrikaner people, would be working class and would be state employed, and would be threatened a lot by blacks for their job security. And a lot of those are far right-wing people. That's another thing I was meant to explain in the beginning, that of the whites, about 60% of people are Afrikaans-speaking and 40% are English-speaking. And believe it or not, I'm English-speaking. again, contrary to popular opinion. it's my first language. English is my first language. But there are big divides between English-speaking and Afrikaans-speaking people. That was economic. In education, an example of the divide between the two language groups is the schools are generally all one language or the other. So I went to English-speaking school, and I seldom have ever come into contact personally with any Afrikaans-speaking person or child. Statistics for that, spending on education, people can see this, $205 for Africans and $812 for whites. And then another statistics, literacy, 53% for Africans and whites, 98%. Generally, the education for whites is really pretty good, depending on what area you are though. Your grade 12 would be comparable to United States grade 12, if not better, depending on the schools. And it would allow you to get into universities. And universities, white universities are really good, and they're comparable to world standards, Western world standards. Okay, education. What am I doing on time? Okay, three more things. Political involvement. I'm going to go from the far right to the left. On the far right is the Afrikaner Weerstandsbeweging, or the AWB. This is a white supremacist type group of Afrikaners that are militant and armed and growing group of people who are very, very scared that de Klerk is giving away Afrikaner power and white power, and are busy arming themselves. Then, and they're outside parliament on the far right. Then parliament, there are three main parties in parliament. There's the Conservative Party, which is far right, the Nationalist Party, which is right wing or conservative, and the Democratic Party, which is liberal. The nationalists are in power, and have been since 1948. And only whites vote for those parties, obviously. And so that's also indicative of where the white sentiment lies. It's still with the nationalists, although it has been eroded to both the left and the right, especially in the last elections. So de Klerk is a nationalist. And then to the left of parliament are the extra-parliamentary politics. And there is a fair percentage of whites who are centered mainly in the three, in the big cities, in Cape Town, Johannesburg and Durban, who would be involved in extra-parliamentary politics. And that would be the United Democratic Front and the African National Congress, ANC, type organizations. And they would reject parliament, that it is whites only, and therefore then they're not prepared to be a part of that. They want to be part of the mass democratic movement, in other words, working with blacks for change. And that's the link, that would be a link with when Modi speaks of political involvement, she'll also speak of the UDF and the ANC. Religion, generally 80% of people in the country are called Christians. I mean, I would say they were Christians. Afrikaners mainly would be Dutch Reformed Church, which is kind of Calvinist tradition, and are very, very devout, and would learn a lot through, I mean, until recently, apartheid was justified theologically by the DRC, the Dutch Reformed Church, and that would be instilled and ingrained in people as they were growing up, and church would be a very, very big part of their upbringing. Recently, though, the DRC did declare apartheid a heresy. And English-speaking people would belong to many different Protestant churches, and some to Catholic, Anglicans, Methodists, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, etc. Okay, the last area is culture. Couldn't think of too many things for that, other to say then, Afrikaner culture is pretty homogeneous, although it is breaking down at certain points. But if you're an Afrikaner, there's a very, very strong identity as an Afrikaner on all different levels. Whereas for English-speaking South Africans, there isn't that same strong identity as such. And often people will harken back to European roots more. I guess the one thing we thought of for sports is that rugby and cricket are the two main sports played. And I guess that's a good point to end on.
Thank you. If you could prepare the questions you have in mind, and Mudie will make an input, and then we can open the discussions and have a conversation.
Okay. Standard of living in a black community or family.
Okay.
Most black families would have would consist of about 8 members. One unit would have about 8 people in the family. And as you see, the monthly wages or income. And you find that most people who are working are women. We have single parent families in African families. And from rural areas to urban areas. And in rural areas, that's predominant, because most of the men work in the mines on contract or as migrant laborers. And so they are contracted to their work and only goes home maybe twice or once in a year or so. And children in the rural areas are left with either the grandparents or the mothers working in the fields as farm laborers. And the mothers would probably also be working as maids or maids in white families. We have a rich, poor, middle class, although the rich Africans are very, very few. And the middle class would consist of teachers, mostly blacks, those who are affording to have would be middle class. But the rest of the, most of the rest of the population are really living below the average standard of living. Political involvement. No, education. Although the schools are subsidized, there is a discrepancy because white children are highly subsidized and black students are not so much subsidized. There is a gap. The others would be subsidized more from school, from primary level up to university. In so much that even this has been has brought about a lot of collision and the boycotts in mainly high schools and universities. And almost every year, every single black university, there's bound to be either a shutdown of the university, sit-ins, boycotts have been made, ranging from academic to ordinary food issues within the universities. And there's a lot of dropouts also in the Africans because mainly of the inequality of education, the age restrictions. There have been an age because the whites are, there is compulsory education for whites, whereas blacks the education is not compulsory. So you find that there's a lot of children go into school at a later age, maybe 8 years. They start school at 8 years because the parents can't afford to take the children to school or for some reason. And so there's a lot of dropout also because parents can't afford to send their children to school or maybe the children are asked to help the parents if maybe the parents are not able to earn enough for the children. At a certain age, maybe 16 or so, a child is forced to leave school to go and work, either as a petrol attendant or some work in factories, clean shops, cinemas, all sorts of jobs. And delinquency, main or crime related, so children drop out of school because of delinquency. Mainly because of single parents. You find that the mother is the only person who's responsible to the child. And there might be some truancy that the child plays, or maybe because the child can't get money to have food in school, or even buy books, because whereas with whites, children just go and they get stationery from school, they are given textbooks, whereas with blacks, we have parents have to see to it that their child has those things. So most of them drop out. And also because of failure rate, the control of schools is determined by the government. How it determines that it will say so much percentage has to pass, and if that percentage has gone through, the rest will just have to be failed. And as a result, children drop out of school and because they don't want to repeat the class, or there is age restriction as well, which forces a child to say that forces children over a certain age not to come back to school, but enroll as private students and study privately. Mm-hmm. And the question of political involvement. As Janelle has said, whites are the only group of people who can vote. So what the government did was to have homelands, and and blacks, they are saying that blacks have the right to vote for their ministers in different homelands. But because the standard of living there is so low, most people move out, especially the working group, working class, they move out of homelands and work in urban areas, it's contracted workers. So people who are left behind are either mostly pensioners and children. And these are the people who are forced by circumstances to vote for these homeland leaders. And other sectors will be councillors within the different black townships. There are so-called councillors who would have maybe the mayor, treasurer, secretary, and all that. But these people, when they really first started, with the governor saying that those blacks who are in urban areas have the right to vote for their mayors or councillors. But they have no power in doing anything, because they also have no economic power, no money to even run the townships. And they are always having to rely on some little money they get from the government and rent. They get money from rent, rent payments, because most of the houses are owned by the local governments. Local governments would be local constituents, local town councils, and as such, people see them as sellouts, because they have no power to actually vote on anything. And if they, and as such, people see them as sellouts, because they can't take people's matters. Like if they say there's no electricity in the township, there's nothing that they can do except to wait for the government to say that, well, this year Soweto can have electricity, or they can have sewage, or they can have highway, they can build roads and everything like that, because they have no economic power. And besides that, there's a UDF, ANC, AZAPO, and PAC. UDF, the United Democratic Front, it's in coalition with ANC, which is African National Congress, because they have the same values. And then AZAPO is a black organization also. But it propagates black unity, but it can include colored and Indians. And then PAC, it's a Pan-Africanist movement, which propagates that Africa for Africans, whites are really Europeans. And as such, there hasn't been any workable political situation that the people find themselves, blacks find themselves, where they can vote for whatever they want, or vote for people they want in parliament, because they are not even represented in parliament. And then when it comes to religion, we have Protestant, Roman Catholic, and indigenous or independent churches, and what we call evangelicals in or Assemblies of God tradition. Yeah. Most of these are political, but you find that let me just pass on that. Okay, on the question of culture, rural areas would have strong traditional roots, and urban areas, well, they can be, there are traditional roots, and you might find some of these dances, traditional dances, or are being carried over to from generation to generation. Also find this in hostels where, like compounds where migrant workers stay. You find that there sometimes on Sunday they have this traditional dance that you can go there and admire. Very beautiful Zulu dances, Sotho dances, you name them. And then people rally around church activity, sports, main sports for blacks is soccer. And church choirs and trade union also is drawing a lot of people. It's a culture on its own. And music. And then youth culture as well is developing very strongly because of the resistance of the youth to the situation in South Africa. And there's a distinct separation between parent and the youth, mainly because of the situation and then what they do in school. I mean, things have changed so much. And then shebeens also are some form of entertainment. We don't have Africans cannot, or blacks cannot go into lounges bars. They're restricted somehow. And very few are open. Actually, I can't think of any which are open to. They're still distinctly separated, white, black. And white, blacks actually don't have them. There are no operating bars in South Africa for blacks. So most blacks go to what they call shebeens. Might be an ordinary house where the person there would own the house and sell out liquor. And you find, in the afternoon, people knock off from work. Most people go to shebeens, sit around, chatting and all that. It's a nice circumstance. Although some tend to drink a lot, but I mean, it depends on the person. We have such things also in bars. So, but these are the form of entertainment where people can relax and enjoy themselves. Language, there are actually two mainstreams, Sotho and Nguni, but and a few variations from the two mainstreams. And street language, which you might find, especially in the Transvaal or around cities like Johannesburg, Durban, where people can speak a mixture of Afrikaans, English, Sotho, Zulu, but in some coordinated way, and people are able to hear. And on the question of interaction, the only time that whites and blacks interact really is on the level of boss and employer, or when police are patrolling the streets or the army. But there is absolutely no interaction. And thank you.
Yes. For those who would like to visit South Africa, people say that you cannot say you have really seen the life in the townships until you have gone to a shebeen, which is where you will meet many people who just empty out their frustrations over a bottle of beer in a loud, with a loud music. I don't know how many of you have seen the film Cry Freedom, where as the Steve Biko were given this white editor an exposure of township life, the first place they took him was a shibin, where there was a loud music, people were dancing and they were drinking from people, and that is the township culture and life. And interesting enough is that the next door you will find another child of the family studying hard for an examination tomorrow with that loud background, mm-hmm. and so on. But it's an interesting thing. And one other little comment is that one of the interesting things in South Africa is that black and white children never don't have vacations at the same time. Or if they do have vacations at the same time, they're not aware that there is the same time. Normally, the holiday breaks would be separate, same time would be around Christmas. But even they do just before that week of Christmas. Otherwise, when white children go to school, the black children are on vacation. And when one black children are on vacation, the white children go to school. And as a result, a completely different culture emerges between these children and so on. Yes, we have taken that. Can we just entertain questions on clarity and other things? Yes.
You mentioned soccer as a popular sport. Can you tell us a little bit about soccer clubs and how they kind of come to be? They serve as organizations for a voice, where they can have a voice, but is that true?
Not so much. I mean, soccer, children start soccer at a very, very early age. I mean, when a child starts walking, it's just introduced to a ball. Any ball can be a rubber ball, a paper ball, plastic ball, just fold plastic together and put some tape, and the child just kicks it. And it's very, and small schools, they have soccer as their sports.
But it hasn't become any kind of organization where youth can get together to demonstrate?
It hasn't.
I thought I remember reading that somewhere or something closely.
They have what you call National Soccer League. There was actually one National Professional Soccer League, but there was a clash, and what evolved was National Soccer League. And they have, I think the first group that got bursaries for, you know, to proceed to school was last year, when the National Soccer League said it's willing to give money to any student who's good in soccer and with good pass. To be able to go to school. But in the past it was just sports, you know, with no attachment even to main. Well, whites have been playing a lot involved in a lot of sports, and as a result there is that demarcation. And a few, there are actually two clubs that are probably in the National Soccer League, white clubs. And one club is actually the university club, the Vets University. And where the Vets University, there are all sorts of, from black and white.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was wondering about, you mentioned that the men go to the mines to work, and the women, you know, are going to the white townships or white cultures to be a maid. I was wondering, you know, if the black townships are so far away from the white places, do they build up little shanty towns along the edge of the cultures, or where do they live when they're working for the white people if the black cultures are so far away from the
Those who come as migrant workers. The women, uh-huh, would live outside the houses. They have they live in one room, maybe attached to the garage, but they never live inside the
But there are two different kinds of domestic workers. There's the live-ins and the people who don't live in. So the live-ins is what Medhi is speaking
of. Coming from the homelands.
They have permission to live in the white suburbs. So they will live in the house where they're working. But she's saying that normally they're separate maids' quarters,
mm-hmm.
where they'll live all maids' room. And then other people will live in the townships. And the townships are part of the city, but they're just on
the
you know, it goes white. In Cape Town, it's white suburbs and then coloured townships and then African townships. And so it might be like a 20-25 minute drive or bus trip in to come into the white suburbs. And often the townships can be either houses, cheap houses, or they can be shanty town type townships. There used to be, when the pass laws were still in existence, women weren't allowed, African women weren't allowed to come into Cape Town to live at all. It was illegal to join their husbands or whatever. So you had all these illegal shanty towns springing up because women were coming to find their husbands or to be with the men and also to earn money because the rural areas were so impoverished. And then you had all these shanty towns springing up with, and most of the women would have been illegal. And that was when the police would come in and raise the townships, or raise the shacks. But that situation isn't quite the same anymore. But, I mean, the townships are all there.
When did that change, that law? 87,
maybe.
87.
Mm. Yes.
This is addressed to all of you. One thing of what I find very disturbing is that you, especially Medhi, the things you described and the statistics you have on the board, we can all shake our heads here, but they are startling. Many of the situations, and especially your educational statistics and the landowning, are comparable to things here in the United States. With the African-American culture countering the white culture, especially in the inner cities. And we don't have specifically any more laws against African-Americans being able to go in certain places, but there is still this, you know, like the, especially the education, the distribution of money for education. And I'm wondering what your views, any of your views are on if laws were to change in South Africa, how you would see that affecting or not affecting the deep-seated racism and discrimination. I feel very, there's a lot of disharmony going on in me and just listening to this and thinking, this is the same that's going on here, but it's just the covers are different.
Were you?
No, I'm just hoping that you will have a chance. I think connected with that, I'll address the, what are some of the political programs for creating a non-racial society in South Africa. I really hope you'll have a chance.
Okay. So,
before I ask a question, may I ask where you got the statistics from?
Mainly, there is an institute in South Africa called the South African Race Relations Institute, which uses the information.
This is not government.
No, but it uses information requested during session in Parliament. So when you read Hansard, which is parliamentary debates in South Africa, you do get that. And race relations compile annual surveys of race relations, and many organizations have access to that thereafter. Many South African watch offices in America do that.
Does the government issue statistics?
It's
the
by law.
You do here?
By law, it must. The member of parliament must just stand up and say, Minister, can you tell me in the past year what was your budget for education? The minister is obliged to give it.
But I mean, no, my question
they do.
Is, are the government statistics
exactly
the same as yours?
Exactly, yes. These are government statistics, yes.
I'm starting to answer that question.
Yeah, I know. I know where we answered it. I think Dan said we should attend to it as part of the future.
Thank you.
has a striking resemblance to the United States versus our American Indians. And we came in and killed them all and took over their lands. Have you ever thought about the relationship between the two?
No, I haven't really thought of the relationship.
Would you say today that South Africa is the leading economic nation of Africa?
It certainly is.
It is?
The leading economic nation of Africa, yes.
Well, how much would you say that the Africans contributed to that from, say, 1850 on when the industry was built?
A number of cumulative factors. Firstly, mineral resources were found. And they were found at a time when the only way to extract those mineral resources was to work hard and not rely on mechanization. And the only employment or labor power they could get was African labor power, which was abundant. If those mines were somewhere in Europe at that time, they wouldn't have been profitable.
But there's no African businesses, what I'm asking?
No.
It was all controlled by the white man?
Yes. Yep.
And the railways were built by, from Cape Town to right across the country were actually put down by...
Land was originally black before the white man got there?
Yes. There's
and
been
they did
resettlement.
Not develop it, correct?
Excuse me, what was the
land was originally black, but they didn't develop, the white man developed, right?
Yeah, well,
it's a loaded statement.
Let me.
I want you to answer the question that was first.
Yeah, too.
Please. Oh. There was already a question on the floor.
Well, with due apology, the land was, say the natives, we call them native, the indigenous people owned land. And if we talk of development, whether were streets made and so on. As the country developed, that development was made, but it was done under the white control when the white people were. The kind of development you can talk about during the 1800s when Africans stayed there is simply that the land was arable, they were able to plow on it, they had places where they built their houses, etc. Why I say that is a loaded statement is because presently the major point of conflict in South Africa is that the white people are saying that granted this land is yours, but when we found it, it was useless. We did it to be this beautiful. And now that is a really highly contestable statement in the sense that on the one hand, you can say we brought the intelligence to build bridges, but you found the resources there, you got the labor power and many things. So it's a really not an easy thing to say that the white developed it. And also that development is, we say that it's a joint venture in the sense that every person was involved in that. So that is where the debate is presently about actually who is responsible for the South Africa that we have, which is certainly a superpower in Africa. Right, come to this. Did you have a question?
Well, I wanted to ask, I think, the same question they were asking.
Okay, so let's not waste time then and go to
then,
it.
Go ahead.
Your question about the problems of South Africa. Firstly, you should realize that in South Africa, this is like this for the one simple reason, unlike in America. And this is that the black people have absolutely no say in what is decided, what is budgeted in parliament. They are not there. They are thankful. They're just at the mercy of saying that we'll give you $2, we'll take $2,000. They cannot question that. They cannot do anything. So that's a major important thing. difference, that they are simply, their voice in parliament is not there. And the person who is in charge of their education is not even elected or voted by them. He's voted by a white constituency, he's representing a black education program. And as a result, you can imagine that what is it that he's going to do? Whom is he going to listen? He's not going to listen to people who did not even vote for him. But the day the black people have a vote, I can tell you for certain that any minister who goes in parliament and put this type of money, he knows that at the end of the term, he's no longer going to be a minister. The situation is continuing as it is presently because they simply do not have, they cannot go to parliament by constitution of the land. Now, a significant difference between South Africa and America is that you have this type of population ratio of really what we may call every 100, 86 would be non-whites and then 14 would be white. A population breakdown, 86% non-whites, 14% whites. In America, it's the exact reverse. Okay, in the sense that you have out of 250 million, I'm not sure if somebody could help me, what's the population of America? But certainly the large majority would be white and the others would be minorities or African American. Now, I'm not sure what is the exact configuration percentage wise. Now, as a result of that, therefore, the similarities that are there here in America and in South Africa are not so much logical in the sense that they are simply, in South Africa, they are a result of political problems, since that the constitution is like that. In America, there could be other reasons for that, not necessarily the same reasons.
So you see the situation largely in South Africa as a result, I mean, you see it more purely as a political situation than in America.
Exactly. Because in South Africa, you can redress that problem tomorrow once you solve the political situation. Whereas in America, you cannot. You can still improve what you have, but as long as the people would feel that that senator is representing Indiana and there are few blacks in Indiana, is not going to be concerned about putting more money for minorities in Indiana. This is the problem. Unless, of course, that he is part of a broader movement that takes seriously those issues, as some sectors of the Democratic Party are saying, etc. That's a different case. But in South Africa, it will automatically, that person will automatically be obliged. Otherwise, he knows he won't be re-elected. And that is where the political future of South Africa is.
So the political power is what changes the mind, what you think will change the minds in South Africa.
Yeah.
How many black parties are
there? Sorry, just to clarify, the one thing though, I mean, things will change pretty radically or drastically once black majority power is realized. But I think the legacy of apartheid is going to continue for many years after that. I mean, you look at figures, literacy figures or education figures, and you realize that kind of legacy carries on for a long time.
Right. I guess that's one thing that I was thinking, well, you know, we don't have these laws, but there's this kind of deep-seated problems still. I guess that's one similarity I was seeing.
Thank you. Let me address the issue of non-racialism. Firstly, what do we mean by non-racialism and how it differs with what? There are five views about the future of South Africa. The first one is the view that every race must develop separately. And this is the view that is presently held by the conservative group. that let white people as white people do things on their own according to their culture, because in any way, if they try to do it with black people, there will be conflict in the sense that these people come from different cultures. So let black people do, but then the argument is that there should be no injustice. Let them simply be separate. So what you call separate but equal type of a approach. The second view is that, no, let us have one. And now, the problem with the first view is that it doesn't answer in a country where you have separate groups. Who is going to be the minister? Who is going to be the foreign minister? Who is going to be what? It doesn't answer that. And if you ask, you are following that logic actually, it simply means that these people who are representing a single unitary government would be from the white community. Now it has problematic. The second view is the recent one that is being promoted by Mr. de Klerk, who's saying that actually let us share as one parliament, let us share power. We simply give each other a ratio. We say that all white people sent 40 seats, the colored people you have 15, the Indians you have got 10, the African people you have got 35, so that we all share equally. Now the obvious objection to that is that you are talking about 14% of people having an equal number with this, but then there are other objections that could be raised. The English-speaking groups in South Africa has opted for what is called multiracialism, which comes close to the first one of segregation, except that it wants every race to be one and then to all of them to develop the same. And so that people can still have their own neighborhoods, can still have their own schools if they so want, etc., etc. And there are a number of the dynamics to that. Now, then there is the view that is represented by mostly black groups on the left spectrum, which is a demand for African leadership or black control, or what you other people call black majority. That is the Pan-Africanist Congress and the Black Consciousness Grouping would go for that. The African National Congress in the middle wants a non-racial society. Basically, it says that when people are to be voted, or when people are voting, the issue of the racial affiliation of a person should not be an issue. If in Soweto there is a medical doctor who happens to be white in color, but we want that person to be the Minister of Health, we have a right to put his name and vote for him. If so-and-so is a well-known anti-apartheid leader, as many white people are known, but he happened to be white, his name can be put. So therefore, those are the major the differences. Now, the question that I was asking is, where in the world do we find that system? People say with limited view, it is happening in Zimbabwe, and it is happening in Namibia. We do not know whether it is succeeding. And I suppose that is basically, when you talk about the future of South Africa, those are the type of configuration people have in mind. It comes to your question where you are asking how many black organizations exist.
Political
organizations. Essentially, we have four. I can mention four.
Now, is it true they can't get along with each other?
It is true they can't get along with each other, in the same way that the Democratic Party in South Africa cannot go along with the Afrikaner resistance group. They can't go along with other for obvious reasons, that one group, which is of Kachaputelezi, wants to organize people on ethnic grounds, and people think that is too divisive. Another group wants to organize people on purely skin, on black affiliation, and other people feel that is too exclusive. So they cannot get along on purely well-defined issues. which has nothing to do with tribal or other things.
How much influence did Desmond Tutu have over there?
Can we take another?
Okay,
sure. I just didn't think you had a question.
How can there be economic justice in South Africa? Do you think that will follow naturally from political justice? Because that seems to be the larger problem, legacy of economic injustice. And changing the political system did not necessarily address that, certainly not for a while. The vote isn't enough, and I think some people look on South Africa in that sort of superficial way, that if only we had democratic elections there, that would somehow solve the problem. Obviously, it has to be more than that.
But maybe a move in the right direction, though.
Well, sure.
Like Jesse Jackson, at least was seriously considered for president of our country. Mm-hmm. He could have won. He could be our next president. We have a lot of problems in our country, but I think it's a move in the right direction. And I can understand the people in South Africa might want some similar rights, even though there's still big problems.
I'm really talking about the American perception of things. When I hear people talking about this issue from purely that point of view in this country, not realizing the extremely complicated economic problems.
Very complicated, and we have a lot to learn from these people, I think.
It's not going to be that much easy, because economic power has to do with even education. Mm-hmm. You to be economically viable, you have to have real engineers, whatever, accountants and all that. We have limited people to fill up those positions. Mm-hmm. And if the illiteracy could be wiped off, you certainly, because there are a lot of jobs to be filled at the moment. We have, in the past years, we've had the government advertising for people to come and work. We've had British, even recently, we've had they've been when the changes in Eastern Europe were happening. There were people who were going to South African embassies in Germany in thousands getting visas, and close to, I don't know, they were saying 200. Mm-hmm. What was the number per day applying for visas to go to South Africa? And those people are offered jobs, but the problem is that those jobs could be offered to blacks if they were given the opportunity to get education and fill up those positions.
What do you see as the role of the church in a non-racial South Africa in bringing this about? I know we've got the time to bring it here. Maybe we shut the door up there.
Can you try that? I think that firstly, people should realize that to want a non-racial society is not as if it's logical or natural. It implies certain values, commitment. What do you believe about human beings, firstly? It is very easy for many people to believe in pan-Africanism, to say that we as Africans must govern ourselves according to our own tradition. But what do you do about those who are not Africans, obviously, as people of foreign, the genel, etc. Now the church can, once it embraces this non-racial, where basically it says that you take it as a creed that race should not be an issue in allocating jobs, in entrance in school, in placing candidates, etc., etc. Then the church can have a contribution. Unfortunately, over the years, the church has not been a good example in the sense that it has always followed behind the government. As a result, it has always been referred to as the national party at prayer. It's the same national party in church, it is simply praying.
One more for Janelle. You said recently the Reformed Church declared apartheid as a heresy. has it really had any effect on that church? Does it make any difference to the way they do things, the way they teach in the church?
Well, I think the government as a whole has said that it doesn't have apartheid as its ideology anymore. You know, it's the reform strategy is now the in ideology or the in thing. So it's in some ways it's I don't know how
the church, but the churches themselves have they changed, or is it just on the books?
I would say to a large part of the Dutch Reformed Church, it's still, it's not, the mentality hasn't changed.
Thank you.